you're mentally putting yourself in the shoes of, you know, having the steering wheel in your hand.
Right.
And I think that's really important because it gives you a lot more confidence, you know, to get to the finish line.
Welcome to the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Doust. Since 2007, Quiet Light Brokerage has been helping thousands of online entrepreneurs realize their dream of buying and selling online businesses. And now, we're bringing all the knowledge our team has acquired straight to you. No matter your niche or industry, these lessons, tips, and strategies will help you build, grow, acquire, or sell your online businesses better. And now, here's Joe and Mark.
It's probably at least once per month that I get an email about a certain company in our industry that seems to be making waves. And the general question that I get, and actually I just got this email a few days ago from somebody else who's been on our podcast, I won't say who it was, but asking, who are these guys over at 101 Commerce? And are they going to be able to do what they keep saying that they're going to try and do? Joe, I know you talked to RJ over at 101 Commerce, people that we know pretty well at this point, and you talked about what they're doing.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty incredible, his ability to network. We've done a podcast on networking, and I'm telling you, just a year ago, I spoke to him, and he came out of the blue and called me and said, this is what we're trying to do. And I told him he was nuts. We laughed a little bit. I should have looked him up on LinkedIn before I told him he was nuts, because he is one impressive guy. What he's accomplished, what he's achieved in the companies that he's built. I had him rattle them off after he did his intro. And I said, stop being humble. Name names here. And everybody listening will know some of the names that he named. But yeah, they're pulling it off. Their goal is to buy 101 Amazon FBA businesses. They love the platform. They love the fact that it's got built-in traffic and an easy advertising platform. And all they have to do is focus on a few things versus driving traffic, which Amazon does for them. And I think they're going to pull it off. It's not going to happen in 24 months, which was the original goal, but they're well on the way. I tried to nail him down on the time frame, and he was a little wishy-washy on the amount of time it would take.
Well, I know the question I get from people on this all the time is it even possible to do what they're doing? Buy 101 companies within 24 months, or even if it's 36 months, I mean, can you buy that many companies? And my experience in this has been that, you know, I've seen people try to do this in the past. You know, I've seen people try to acquire multiple businesses and roll them together and build this portfolio, and they always end up running into buying a dog here and there, or having an issue come up, or trying to expand a team that quickly. So my response to people is pretty much universal. And RJ, you know, if you're listening to this, hopefully you're listening to this, I'll tell you exactly what I tell everyone. It's really, really hard to do. But out of the people that I've met, he's probably the one person I would bet on being able to do this. And so I'm like a lot of other people, I've grabbed my popcorn and I'm sitting back and I'm watching, because this is really fascinating to watch them go through. How many are they up to right now as far as acquisitions that they've completed?
I think the last time we chatted, and we didn't get into specific numbers on the podcast, but the last time we chatted, I think it was about 14 brands. And they're trying to get their systems and their processes in place and bring on more and more people. They ended up doing, I think, 8 businesses for 14 brands with a total of 3 people. And then they realized we need to have some operations here and build some systems and processes. So they've been hiring like crazy, and some really, really talented people. So I'm with you. I think if anybody can pull it off, there's a few that I think could, but I think RJ and his team are one of them. We've had some other folks that are doing similar things, as you know, that have brought purchased a couple from us. Brad in particular has sold 2 to them recently, but I think they'll pull it off. I think it will take longer than the 24 to 36 months. I'd be betting on more from beginning to end, maybe a total of 60 months. It's a big undertaking.
Yeah, and folks, just I want to say that, have you say that again? How many and how long?
101 businesses.
Now, how many have they done so far?
Oh, 14 brands, essentially 8 purchases, but within that, I believe there were 14 brands. And that, it's been less than a year. I think the first one happened early in the summertime. So it's really less than 6 months.
Absolutely incredible. And we're seeing this from a few different places. I know we had Shaquille Prazla on quite a while ago now, and talking about how many he's bought. And he's bought more since we had him on, when he had at that point amassed 8 different companies, that acquisitions that he had done over just a few years. So there are ways to do this. And by the way, Shaquille's method is different than what RJ and 101 is doing. So there are a few different paths towards building up this portfolio and really scaling up pretty quickly. Fascinating example of somebody doing this at scale within the industry. And definitely, I'm sure this is going to pop up there as one of the more popular episodes.
So let's you and I stop talking about it and hear what RJ has to say.
Sounds great.
Today's guest is Richard Jalichandra. Actually, RJ, how are you doing today, RJ?
I'm doing great, Joe. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Good to see you. Hey, let's do the thing where you tell everybody about you instead of making me read the script. Can you give everybody some background on yourself?
Yeah, I'm an old digital entrepreneur. Got into the internet in January of 94, building my first website for an agency client, and been doing it ever since. I've done a whole bunch of different things. I'm a five-time CEO now, but also held senior exec positions at a whole bunch of venture and PE-backed companies. So just kind of been around the block for quite a while. And then tried to retire last year. And then something I think you're probably going to ask me about kind of like got a bug in my ear. In fact, your podcast got in my ear a few times and maybe influenced my current gig. But yeah, recently we founded 101 Commerce, and essentially what 101 is doing is we're buying, investing, and launching theoretically 101 niche e-commerce private label brands on Amazon. And, you know, we're a little bit into it, as you know.
But yeah, a little bit. I remember that first conversation we had, some guy named RJ called me out of the blue. I should have looked you up on LinkedIn before I told you you were nuts, because that's exactly what I said. You remember the conversation?
Like, yep.
Dude, you're nuts. You're going to buy 101 Amazon businesses. You're going to run them, operate them, build a staff around it. You're crazy.
You weren't the only one.
You might still be crazy, but you're pulling it off. Well, listen, you're being very humble here in terms of your background. Come on, share some of the businesses that you started and you ran. Come on. It's name dropping. Please do it so everybody knows.
Well, some of the ones that are, I mean, depending on what your flavor is, whether it's fitness or video games or, let's see, a couple of, I mean, I've done a bunch of things, but the ones that seem to kind of ring a bell on everybody. The video game space, I was one of the senior execs at a company called IGN Entertainment, where we ran a massive gaming network that reached 50 million dudes, 13 to 34 year old dudes a month. And famously, of all the acquisitions I did there, the one that always, like, you know, delights people at cocktail parties was Rotten Tomatoes. So I did a bunch of acquisitions there, but Rotten Tomatoes is kind of the one that I can throw out there. And all of a sudden, everybody's like, wow, you did Rotten Tomatoes. I'm like, no, I didn't found it, but I did buy it. I'm really good friends with the founders of it still today. Then, let's see, I ran something called Technorati, which at one point was a social media darling until a small search engine company in Mountain View did you know, some things that made it very hard to compete from other search engines. Then I ran it. No, we won't name any names, but just some small company in Mountain View. And then, let's see, after that, I did a fitness company called Map My Fitness, which was then sold to Under Armour. And that was a really successful, fitness set of apps, Map My Run and Map My Ride. So if you're into cardio, a lot of people touch those at some point. Then I did a company nobody had ever heard of. It was an enterprise media space, advertising media space. I ran Behind the Brands, sold that in 2014, and then tried to retire then. And then I decided to do one more fitness gig and was the CEO of bodybuilding.com. And then that led to my second retirement attempt. Then here we go.
Maybe the third time will be a charm. I think the list of businesses you just mentioned probably touched on 90% of the people listening know of at least one, if not more of those, especially the Map My Fitness and all that good stuff. All right. So about 18 months ago now, or no, it's less than a year ago, or about a year ago, you and I had a conversation and you said, hey, look, I'm reaching out. We're putting together a fund. We're going to buy 101 Amazon businesses. Why? Why are you focused on Amazon? Why are you not retiring like most sane people would do when they have the ability? No, skip that. Why are you buying 101 Amazon businesses? What's the theory? What's the plan? What's the concept?
Well, I'll back up a little bit and kind of tell you how I stumbled into it.
Okay.
So, you know, I mean, I was going to try and retire. I'm still young enough, though, where I figured at some point I might jump back into, you know, a CEO chair or something like that. So, but I promised my wife I was going to take 2 years off, no W-2ing, you know, just literally going to play golf, mountain bike, you know, have some fun, raise my daughter, advise, maybe do some angel investing. And that was kind of the plan. But I was also like going, if I ever do want to get back in the chair, you know, it'd be kind of hard to do if I just was really on the beach for 2 years and not really educating myself. So I had this idea that I was going to buy a solopreneur 4-hour work week business, which I'm sure you've heard that one a few times in your job. A
couple of times.
Yeah, a couple of times today. But that was literally the goal, was to buy a 4-hour work week gig.
Yeah.
And I wanted something that was, you know, at least a couple of years old, you know, so somebody had also already done all the hard work. You know, I've done early stage startups and I know how hard they are to get things off the ground. I wanted something that was more kind of mature and seasoned, where I was more twisting knobs, you know, than actually lifting heavy boxes.
Yeah.
I looked at a whole bunch of stuff, not just Amazon businesses. I looked at, you know, SaaS content. I have a lot of experience in content. I sold a SaaS company. I looked at lead gen, affiliate, and I looked at digital content. I was on the board of a company called ClickBank, which a bunch of your listeners have probably heard of as well. I was the chairman there. So I knew a lot about in that ecosystem. So I was looking at a whole bunch of different things and I kept coming back to Amazon FBA. And the more I dug in on it, I was just kind of blown away by the operating leverage that you get out of Amazon FBA. I mean, essentially, as I explain it to people when I'm trying to pitch investors or just tell people what I'm doing is, you know, my last real job, you know, we had 800 employees, 6 fulfillment centers, 500 people in the warehouse. And, you know, you had to generate your own traffic. You had to, you know, spend tens of millions of dollars on advertising and all that. Essentially, with Amazon FBA, you've outsourced all those hard things. You don't have to worry about fulfillment. You certainly don't have to worry about traffic because you have 300 million of the highest converting consumers there are. So, and then, of course, you know, the advertising platform is built in. You know, the customer service system is built in. So basically, I kept meeting and hearing about and listening to on various podcasts, including yours, people who were, you know, essentially running these really good businesses at really good net margins. And I would be shocked, you know, there's plenty of people kind of running sub $1 million businesses. But every once in a while, I'd meet somebody running a $15 million business that was essentially a sole proprietor with a couple of VAs, and they were running a 30% net. I'd scratch my head and go, wow, that's a way better business model than setting up your own e-commerce site and batting your head against, you know, Google and Facebook and, you know, trying to get traffic as well as having to compete against an Amazon itself. Why not lean into it, take advantage of that operating leverage and see if you could build something that was incredibly profitable at scale.
Now, what about the risk? You know, a lot of folks that I talk to say, no, I don't want to buy an Amazon business. I think there's too much competition. It's too much risk. And Amazon might pull the rug out from underneath me. They may just decide someday they don't want any more seller accounts or third-party sellers. What do you have to say to those folks?
You're right. Just go away. Don't look at Amazon businesses.
My answer is there are people out there like RJ that are a lot smarter than me that are doing it. So there must be something okay with it.
Look, I mean, there is no doubt there is platform risk, of course. But when I was out in the open web, there was platform risk as well. I've had Google, like I said, destroy one of the highest profile companies that I was at. Oh, did I say that name? I shouldn't have said that. You know, but I mean, other places. And I've seen it happen.
Okay. Don't worry about it.
Okay. All right. All right.
Panda update, Penguin update. They've all affected. Those have affected probably, again, 90% of the people listening. So it's okay. They're probably happy.
So everybody knows what I'm talking about.
Yes.
There's platform risk wherever you go. And even in today's thing where Google doesn't have quite the sway they used to, now you have Facebook and Instagram risk because those are the big traffic drivers of other third-party traffic sources and stuff. So you're always going to have platform risk. And I just got comfortable with it because, you know, the FBA and the marketplace ecosystem on Amazon is literally what's driving its growth right now. I mean, if you look at all the stats behind the curtains or whatever, it's you know, driving the growth. And, you know, if you look at 20 years of operating history and behavioral study on Jeff Bezos, he usually doesn't throttle things that are growing like a weed.
That's true. He doesn't. That's a good point. That's the answer I'm going to use from now on when people ask me about that risk. All right. So in terms of,
but I will make it clear, you know, there's a lot of stupid things you could do that get you into trouble. And there's some inadvertent things that could happen to you that do present risk. I don't want to make it sound like
it's not risk-free.
It's not risk-free. And we certainly are going into this with our eyes wide open, knowing that even, the best laid plan, buy 100 of these things, who knows what happens? You know, there's a portfolio theory and it goes both ways, good and bad.
Right. Now, Mark had an expert on from a PE firm in the last podcast. Actually, I listened to it yesterday. By the time this airs, it's probably 3 or 4 weeks ago. And the concept was, you know, buy them at a certain multiple, pull them together, and it's worth more automatically. We've all talked about that concept. Is that what struck you initially, in addition to the scalability because of the platform itself?
Well, first thing you should do is you should introduce me to that guy and we should get to know each other because there may be something we could do. The second thing is, I mean, there's more to it than that. If it was just a financial arbitrage, I probably wouldn't be that interested in it. There's a lot of places where you can do financial arbitrage. I love e-commerce. So first off, that just, you know, gets me from a personal standpoint. But what I like is, you know, just knowing that they're with resources, working capital, domain expertise, specialty expertise, how much you can grow these things is really kind of what interests me. Like I said, I'm not just interested in the financial arbitrage. I would correct something else that you said, kind of at the outset that we raised a fund. A lot of people think that's kind of what we do because they don't understand kind of the PE and venture markets. But I would absolutely categorize us not as a fund. We are absolutely an operating company that works closely with venture and private equity funds.
Yeah, it's funny. We're trying to put a label on you recently and what you do and what some other folks are doing. And what is the label? You're just a company that happened to get some, that you went out and raised money and are investing it in Amazon businesses. Is there an official label for your type of organization, or is there not?
Well, what we're trying to do is create a next generation CPG company. I mean, consumer product goods, consumer packaged goods, more than a CPG because Amazon, obviously sells more. But essentially what we're doing is we're putting together a wide and broad portfolio of niche private label brands that sell predominantly, not exclusively, but predominantly on Amazon. And that's really what it is. It's basically a multi-brand platform. You know, you could think of it as any multi-brand, consumer goods company like a Procter & Gamble or something like that.
Okay. So not unlike our friend Bill D'Alessandro at Element Brands and what he's doing with a little bit more specialty niche and
absolutely
not solely focused on Amazon. Okay.
No. And I love what Bill's doing too, but it's very similar. He's a multi-brand strategy, although he's taking a little more narrow focus than we are.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk for the sellers that are listening.
Okay.
What is it that you and your team look for? What pops out to make you go, I love that opportunity? Is it brand? Is it gross margins? Is it workload? Is it, what three or four things do you generally look for when you're looking at one of these opportunities?
So, I mean, the first three things we look at when we're just doing the highest level screens, like when you send materials out, we're just looking for a couple of really broad things because, there's a lot of these for sale. You know, between you guys bring us, absolutely great deal flow. You know, Joe's probably going to work this in at some point, but of our first cohort, almost 50% of the deals were from Quiet Light. So thank you for that. But you guys do a great job. That said, some of your competitors also do a really good job putting together great materials and all that. So when we're evaluating stuff, we're trying to screen just the sheer volume of things that come through, through the door. So we look at gross margin and net margin. That tells us a kind of a lot about, the health of a business and what the, opportunities are. But of course, in Amazon, the currency there is reviews. So we're looking for what we term review structure. It's not really a good phrase because what it really means is your relative strength, the velocity of reviews, quality of the reviews, how the reviews were generated. But right off the bat, what we're trying to do is look at kind of those three broad metrics to decide if we want to dig deeper or not.
Okay. And once you find a business that checks all of those boxes, do you then go and jump right to the financial or conversations with the sellers? Or do you say, okay, what platforms are they selling in the US, or can I expand internationally? Is there something else like growth opportunities that sort of takes it over the top?
Well, one of the other things I love about what the materials you guys send us, and some of, you know, again, some of your other
thank you. Include the competitors, because this isn't about padding quality brokerage.
No. I mean,
I will pull a quote out of this just for the right.
That's all right. So and it's not just you, but you know, the other top brokers and guys that really put together quality materials and stuff. It really does save us a lot of time, because normally you'd have to do a screening call before you even want to set up a call with somebody. But because of the interviews that you guys do, you get to hear a little bit of the narrative. I think this is something that people forget in when they're trying to sell businesses or sell anything. Story and narrative is really important. If you basically have, you know, a very good narrative for everything from how you originally, you know, what you did before you even started the business, and then how that morphed into a business, that narrative is really important for me to hear. And it's really important when I'm out pitching, you know, our investors as well. You know, and, you know, there's a lot of investment opportunities, a lot of money floating around and whatever, but they want to know, they kind of want to hear your story and you know, how the whole thing kind of morphed into what it is. And same thing when I'm looking at even, you know, the smallest mom and pop business I've ever bought, I want to know about them, where they're from, what they did, you know, in their previous career, and then how all of a sudden this thing kind of caught fire. Because that's really the moment, like most of the things that cross those three bars, you know, the first initial bars, somehow or another, they've gotten some critical mass. They've figured something out. Yeah, in spite of the fact they might not have working capital, they might not be a rocket scientist or an expert on PPC or fulfillment or something, they figured something out. And that's kind of what we want to hear in that narrative.
And the person behind the business, I think is what you're saying, matters tremendously. It's
absolutely the numbers. So in addition to that narrative, the way they present that narrative tells you a lot about them, whether or not, and again, you can get this just by reading, you know, your memorandums. You can kind of get whether they're out for a quick buck or, you know, they're kind of, you know, at the end of their line and maybe just running out of gas and, you know, it's time for them to kind of move on and hand somebody who has more gas. Right. And it's also, you know, part of that narrative is getting me excited about, you know, the product category or something like that. But it tells you, and of course you're going to get to the, yeah, I know you're going to ask this, but, you know, by the time we actually get on the phone with somebody, or in video or whatever, one of the most important things is to understand if the person is a person of integrity. Are they honest? It's awesome, kind of like when you get on that first call. It's usually not in the books. Occasionally it's in one of the books, but usually on that first call, a really honest person is telling you, okay, here's all the warts. Here's all the, you know, the things that aren't going well, that need to be addressed. I wish I could do better, that kind of thing. So I think that's really important, you know, so narrative, and then the integrity comes out in that. And then certainly I want to know, you know, don't ever try and kind of hide the bad stuff, because you tell a great story and then you get in diligence and all of a sudden, you know, the warts start appearing and you're like, well, you didn't tell me about that. Then there's an integrity.
Yeah. And you lose that trust. And this is not rocket science for the, maybe the other brokers that are listening or people that are trying to sell their own business on their own. It's important to act with full disclosure and ask those questions and answer them thoroughly, so that when you do get on that phone call, that trust is continued, you know, to be built. And as I say, look, creating a great package is not the hard part. Connecting with great buyers like yourself, RJ, is not the hard part. Going on a letter of intent is not the hard part. The hard part is getting from letter of intent all the way through due diligence to closing. And if you do everything right pre-LOI, that becomes easier. Things still go off the rails. You and I had one go off the rails a little bit this summer and got back on. But it helps tremendously with full disclosure and trust being built and the people behind the business acting with integrity. It's not just the numbers.
Right. Well, and the other thing you get by, you know, those disclosures too, is we also start operating the business pre-close. And I think that's a really important, you know, thing. I mean, you're not operating the business, but you're starting to think like the operator.
I was going to say, you don't get any control of anything.
No, you're mentally putting yourself in the shoes of having the steering wheel in your hand.
Right.
And I think that's really important because it gives you a lot more confidence, you know, to get to the finish line.
So let's talk about that in 101's operations. When you buy a business from a solopreneur or someone who has a, you know, small staff or VAs, are you generally, and I know the answer to this, are you generally taking it over completely or are you bringing them on to help operate the business with you?
That's a TBD. I mean, it really depends on the entrepreneur, the situation. You know, frankly, there are some people that they're just done, you know, they want to go do something else. Yeah. This was their side hustle. They really love what they're doing. They may have financial reasons that they want to get out. We are looking for the rare entrepreneur. And the other thing is they could even want to jump on our boat, but they may not have the right personality to be in a really high speed, you know, tech thing where you got to work in it as part of a team. And, you know, anytime you put more people together, they're humans and things don't always work right when humans interact, even with the best of intentions. So it really is a TBD thing. If there are, you know, in our first cohort, we were probably looking to just take the businesses and actually create kind of a sandbox with these where we could build kind of a, what I call platformization of the company, people, processes, frameworks, technology that would allow us to go do this, you know, another 100 times and 100 times after that. So that said, of the first 8 businesses that we bought, we now have, I'd call it 2 principals have joined us from those 8. One was an owner and one was literally the guy, like the GM who was running the business.
Okay. They're going to help you with the other, 93 that you buy? Is the plan and the goal?
Gotcha. 93 is the next milestone. And then we'll see what happens after that.
You can do that in 2019 or it's going to take a little longer?
It's probably going to take a little longer then.
Okay. I'll help as much as I can.
I know you will.
talk to us about the importance of having a good presentation and package together before you ever get on that phone call. In terms of, look, I mean, to be blunt, you and I talked about you coming on the podcast a while ago, and I said, no, I said, it didn't make sense because I didn't want people reaching out to you directly. And then I saw you up on the stage at Brand Builder Summit. Big advocate now of a few different things. One is working with brokers because everything is handed to you kind of on a silver platter. But then I think also you've talked about specific attorneys and things of that nature. What are those few things that you think now that you've learned and you've got a certain amount of deals under your belt that you're going to sort of also, not just in terms of the business 3 checkboxes, but your processes going forward for somebody that is also maybe building a portfolio, even if it's a smaller content site portfolio, things of this nature, what certain things are you trying to put in place, like working with brokers, like working with certain attorneys and things of that nature? Anything you can?
You hit on the mother load there. Let's go in no particular order, but let's start off first with the broker, no broker question. So, you know, people heard about what we were doing, you know, the word kind of got out there. And frankly, we had hundreds of leads that came in through our website. Very few of those, for a surprising number, that would have crossed kind of our, you know, minimum thresholds and stuff that you would have been interested in. But when we do a deal like that, we have to do a heck of a lot more work, a lot more work. And it's kind of hard for us to sift through that. If they don't come with, you know, their own package, financials, a really good narrative, you know, good transparency, it's going to be a lot of work for us. And most people don't know how to sell business. Selling business is hard. So we're happy, very happy to work with brokers because we feel there's a couple of things that brokers do. You validate a deal for us. I mean, basically, you're not just going to take your time is valuable. You have other opportunities and things like that. So we know that you're already taking a little bit of a quality. You're checking a quality box. And then, of course, you know, you're helping put together really nice financials and things like that. Things that, you know, are going to make it really fast for us to kind of do that. And then I'd say another really important thing for a buyer to consider, and then we're going to get to the lawyer and other professional services, because frankly, brokers are provided in professional service. When you're selling a business for the first time, or even the second time, third time, fourth time, fifth time, but certainly the first time, if you've never done it before, it is going to be emotionally traumatic.
I knew you were going to go there. It is so emotional.
And it's your baby. Mm-hmm. It's your baby. And, you know, the guys on the other side of the table, they're professionals and they do this for a living or whatever. And it's not that you're going to feel like you're outmatched. It's just you've never been through it before. And it's incredibly stressful. And some buyers are going to ask, you know, they've got investors and they require them to check a whole bunch of boxes before they actually write a check. So they're going to ask you to check all those boxes too. And that can be incredibly stressful. So having a shoulder to cry on, i.e. your broker, and play, you know, personal therapist.
Or vent too.
Yeah, no, that's it. A lot of it is just like, I cannot tell you, you know, I mean, I bought a small business once, probably 14 years ago. I bought a small business that wasn't represented by a broker. And I am not exaggerating when I tell you I hired him a therapist. I will pay for it because otherwise we're not going to, neither of us is going to get what we want because the guy was going to fall apart. Yeah. And so I have a feeling a lot of people probably underestimate just how hard the emotional side of getting a, you know, a seven figure deal done. There's a lot at stake on both sides of the table and the nerves are really frayed. So there's a lot there. And of course you guys do a lot on just the sheer process side that is there. But I always say that's an underestimated, really big value thing, just being the therapist through the whole process.
Yeah, it does. It takes a good buyer too, a good broker, a good buyer. But what about the attorney side of it? You've had some experiences with great attorneys and maybe some tough ones too. What is your view in terms of that aspect? I think you and I talked about at one point where you're going to, are you still considering requiring your sellers to work with a select group of attorneys that you know have e-commerce experience?
Yes. So, and before I even get to that, I would just give this as a huge bit of advice to any seller. Do not use your family attorney.
I have an unwritten rule that if somebody comes to me and they want me to sell their business, I ask them point blank, do you have an attorney? And, you know, are they related? Is it your mother, brother, father, sister, cousin, aunt, uncle, et cetera? Because I had an experience where I had someone that was a few years out of grad school. They started a business in college. We got the business under letter of intent, over asking price. And it was a few years ago, so I was fairly new, RJ. But his mentor in grad school was an attorney by trade. His fiance was in law school, and his mother and father were attorneys. The deal blew up. It was a one-sided contract, and there was absolutely no way to fix it. And the buyer was fantastic. It was very fair. It was fantastic. It blew up, went away, and I learned that lesson. So what you're saying right now to anybody that wants to have a relative as an attorney, it's a really bad idea because they're going to fight like rabid dogs for things that don't necessarily matter and kill the deal for you. Is that what you're saying?
No. And I would take it even a step further. I actually wouldn't mind if they were, you know, your family attorney, if they happen to be an e-commerce lawyer, because the domain expertise is also really important. You can't just take somebody, you know, even if they've done M&A but they sold, you know, dry cleaner chains or something like that. E-commerce and digital assets are just different. And so if you don't have a lawyer who has the domain expertise there, we're probably going to have issues because we're going to have to spend a lot of time educating. So I would highly recommend, and look, you know, Joe can recommend, most of the brokers have, you know, stables of good recommended lawyers, but just because you have a lawyer, maybe you have a good business lawyer, don't necessarily use that one. Look for somebody with the exact domain expertise of what you're getting into. And then the last thing I'd say about lawyers is lawyers love to point score. I mean, this is kind of what they got, you know, graded on in law school when they were doing law review and all that. They like point scoring. And the one thing, a bit of advice I give to anybody who hires a lawyer is remember the lawyer works for you, not the other way around. So you need to watch whether they're going into point scoring mode just for the sake of winning points. And then you have to understand it's not 100 points in a deal. it's usually like four or five that matter. And yet there's these long contracts. It's four or five that matter. And there may be one or two that really are important to you. And that's kind of what you need to focus on. Make sure that you manage your lawyer so that they, know what's important to you. And you're not worried in section 17 and 19 where it's dotting I's and crossing T's and that's some warranties and things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
I agree 100%. If I could look back at all the transactions, for the most part, the buyers are good people, the sellers are good people. And if we lived in a different world, they could shake hands and the deal would be done.
Yep.
We do have to have contracts. We do have to have attorneys, but it needs to be a fair and balanced deal for both parties.
Yep.
Simple. I've only had one deal fall apart because of the attorney. And it was in fact, that situation that I just mentioned. Let's talk for a minute, jump over to owning an Amazon business for the people that are buying. We talked about what you look for from sellers, but from people that are buying, what are your thoughts on if it's a 100% US based Amazon business and they've got the capital, in your opinion and experience now, should they look at either expanding the SKUs in the US or maybe looking at the EU and different marketplaces, or does it simply depend upon the brand?
Yeah, no, I think it's highly contextual. Every situation is going to be very different. There's a ton of these Amazon podcasts that say, SKU expansion, international expansion, which both require working capital. I don't think it's as simple as that. I think you really have to kind of look. I have met people literally in the last month where they tried to go overseas and failed miserably because their product category just wasn't appropriate for, European market or whatever market. Okay. So I think it really is highly dependent there, but it's certainly worth investigating. One of the things I like about Amazon is that you can experiment relatively cheaply. For thousands, if not low tens of thousands of dollars, where you may not get hurt too badly if you made a big mistake. Essentially, taking existing products and doing a small MOQ and launching it in Europe. If it fails miserably, again, if you have the right gross margin structure, you're probably not going to lose money. It may have been an opportunity cost. But look, if you're going to be successful, and you've said this on your podcast, you got to take some swings at the plate, and you're not always going to hit the ball.
Gotcha. All right, let's talk about another big fear, given that you're an expert in this space now and you own, I'm not going to say exactly how many, and neither are you, probably, let's say more than 10 brands and FBA businesses altogether. How big is your fear of potential tariffs hitting your individual brands? Does it keep you up at night? Does it hit every single brand or certain categories? Can you just touch on that as an owner in this space now?
Sure. Really, it also is highly dependent on your exposure to Chinese manufacturing. So, yeah. So we certainly have our fair share of products that are manufactured in China. It's certainly something that we're monitoring and that we're thinking about. At the same time, and Joe, this personally, we've expanded rapidly into Europe. We own two European businesses now. And, so we will look heavily. It's expanding even more with Chinese-based products as we go into Europe.
And shipping to Europe and not being impacted. Is that okay? And will you have an opportunity? Have you done the financials? Does it make sense if you do that and ship from China to Europe to then, import from Europe to the U.S. and avoid the tariffs? Or is that just simply too much cost shipping-wise?
No, that's a great idea, Joe. You should come work for us on supply chain.
No, thanks. I'm not that detailed. You guys smarter guys than me. I know one of them, a lot of them actually. Is that something you guys are already working on and something you've crunched the numbers on? Come on. I know you probably have.
I think it's still early days. And, look, we're thinking about it a lot. We're thinking about, there's two ways to think about it. If everybody gets it, everybody's on a level playing field, but it's not that simple. If it changes the price dramatically, where there's price elasticity of demand issues in the category, that can just impact overall demand. So look, we're worried about it. We're hoping that it gets resolved. And most of the time, what you see in these geopolitical things is there usually is a small period of exposure, and then everybody actually finally sits down at the table and gets the problem fixed. So that's what we're hoping with. Knock on wood.
Let's both do it. Everybody else do it now as well. All right, let's talk about a first, at least a first for me, and I think a first for QuietLine Brokerage, although we've got a second in place now. It may happen before we close. On a transaction that we did together, we actually instead of selling or transferring control of the Amazon seller account entirely, we tested and successfully moved a brand from a well-established existing seller account, took the ASINs and tested it in another account that you happen to own. Can you talk about that a little bit for those? And I'll tell you why, because there's always a fear. Some people want to keep their seller account, in particular over in the European markets. For some reason, some people are a little bit more fearful in some of the countries. Some it's a legitimate fear, others it's, I would say, not. But we tested that and it, can you just touch on that and what you did there and what you prefer, whether it's buying a brand and moving it into your own seller accounts or buying the seller account entirely and what the difference is between the two for you guys?
Yeah, no. We'll just talk about the actual experience. So yeah, we had our own questions. You know, the exact process that we used was we did a test. So we didn't move all of the ASINs over at once. We took three ASINs, a top selling ASIN, a medium selling ASIN, and actually it was two medium selling ASINs and one longer tail ASIN. I didn't want to jeopardize or risk, you know, a top selling ASIN. And so we moved that into this other seller account. It was not equal. It wasn't too far behind, but it was definitely a smaller seller account than the one where they originated from. And so then we ran a seller account.
Were the reviews on the second seller account that you moved in, into with a seller account reviews better or worse than the one
worse
from? Worse. Okay.
They weren't bad. That's the worst.
Bad, but
you know, they just weren't as many.
4.5 to 4 or something like that. Okay. Just wanted to clarify.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I think it was like, you know, 2000 to like 1200 or something.
Okay.
Like that, overall reviews.
All right.
But look, I mean, the product reviews go with the ASIN. So that's the really important thing in a seller account. You know, if you were selling third party products, you know, if you're selling Nikes and there are 20 other vendors selling Nikes and you're fighting for the buy box, then your seller rating is a heck of a lot more important.
Right.
Than the case where you're private label.
Right.
But that's important for people.
The big mystery and big unknown that so many experienced Amazon sellers, people that are doing, you know, $500,000, $1 million a month, you know, it's, we don't know how important those seller account reviews are. What, you know, when you, I mean, they're, obviously they're important in some way, but when you go from 4 stars to 4.5 or 4.5 to 5. So in this case, you moved some of the ASINs over. Obviously, the review, product reviews carry over. I think we did a 3-week test and talk about how it turned out and we ended up closing the transaction.
Yeah, it was a 15-day test and then 15. We extended it for a couple of days. So it was just under 3 weeks. And, you know, the seller was awesome. You know, he was super cooperative. You know, we were also, you know, risk averse. He was risk averse. We were risk averse. So we really cooperated well to see if we could make the test as well. The other thing, we had to, replicate his PPC campaign so they were identical.
Yeah. Was that an automated process or a manual process?
I was
replicating it.
You know, I didn't do it myself, Joe. So I can't tell you the exact process. I try and keep my hands where they're good, and that's not one of them.
Okay.
but from what I understand, the seller actually, you know, created these campaigns for us and literally proved that it was a cut and paste. And then our team put it into the into our seller account, and then he had access to our seller account too, or you know, viewing access or whatever, so that he could make sure that it was set up. Because, like I said, he was incented to make it work.
Yeah.
So he wanted it to work.
Yeah.
And then you know, we had a couple of checks in there on our side to make sure that there was no way that he could game the situation, even though we didn't really have any fear with him in particular. But it is something that you'd want to like at least you know have a couple of. You know, a couple of safeguards that, you know, somebody's not running a big Facebook campaign and juicing the results or something like that.
Right. Right. All right. So just for point of clarification for everybody listening, the typical way that an Amazon business transfers is that the entire seller account transfers. These are generally asset sales. The new owner takes control of the seller account and you're left with an empty shell and a corporation of your corporation. What we did in this situation was move the ASINs from one seller account to another. All the product reviews carried over. The seller account wasn't as high quality. Tested it out for a few weeks on a few ASINs and duplicated the sponsored account. And it turned out great. The seller has to help and it's in their best interest. And this is this is the big picture thing here, Richard. It takes, and you've talked about it throughout here, it takes, you know, a good buyer and a good seller to make a deal work. It's nothing is cut and dry. There's lots of emotions involved in the process when you're selling. And even for a first-time buyer, some people they're putting their life savings on the line and they want to make the right choice. So emotions run high all across the board. And it's never a winner-take-all situation. Both the buyer and seller have to be happy at the closing table. And it begins way back at the initial call and building a good package and managing your own personal brand and reputation, doing the right thing as a seller, and thinking someday maybe you're going to exit, maybe you're going to pass it on to your kids. Either way, you want to pass on something really great, because if your kids take it over, you want them to be successful because it may be your retirement monies. And if you pass it on to someone else, you're willing as a buyer, Richard, RJ, to pay more for a company that is really tidy and neat, and you're able to just take off with it as opposed to sifting through the details and fixing things first, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, and I'm going to say something that my team will probably kick me in the shins over, but I fundamentally believe this, and my mentor who kind of trained me in my career, is he always said, always be willing to overpay for a great asset. Because the good ones are hard to find, you know, and as you were saying that, so again, if somebody is really running a great business, you know, we're not going to get in a pissing match over a couple tenths of a multiple or something like that, because ultimately, yeah, if it's a great asset, we know what we're going to be able to do with it downstream. And, you know, those are going to be rounding errors. And when we look back, but you mentioned, you know, as you were saying that, you know, one of the things I'd like to remind sellers too, is that, and I'm sure you kind of educate them as you bring them on board, but you know, there's a lot of these businesses out there. In 2017, Amazon announced that there was 20,500 $1 million sellers. So there's a lot of choice. Even if we're only trying to buy, you know, 100 of them, you know, whatever.
Did you just read Walker's book? What's going on here? You just quoted him exactly, or maybe you guys are reading the same stuff. Walker published a book called Buy Then Build. No,
yeah.
Wait, yes, Buy Then Build. You're not quoting him, you're just quoting
him. No.
Right.
If you heard my narrative, you would hear that. but I think what I'm getting at, though, is don't be a pain in the ass, you know, because we looked at 400 businesses in 60 days. And we put, in that first 60 days, I think we put 8 into LOI, and then we bought a few more and whatever. My point is that at some point in this, when we had a couple of the early ones get difficult, I remember being, Kate and Chris, they're sitting there and I'm listening to a conference call with a seller and a broker. And I literally got up on the whiteboard and I got in giant letters and I wrote next exclamation point. And that became a kind of a mantra, is if you're not packaged up well, it's not even if you're a jerk or whatever, but if you're not packaged up and buttoned up, there's a lot of other choice out there. And the same goes for, you know, if you're a really good asset, there's also a lot of choice for you to who you sell to as well. If you're a really well-run business and you're dealing with a jerk, tell your broker, find me the next one.
Well, let me say this. You're saying to the sellers, don't be a pain in the ass. To the buyers, the seller does have choices. You know, the first time I was on a conference call with Keith, we were on the call late at night with Max. Max was over in Europe, and Keith was so professional, so good, so likable, to the point where when the call was done, my seller wanted Keith to be the buyer. We had calls with other buyers. He wanted Keith to be the buyer in 101 Commerce. That is what you want to accomplish, buyers. On those conference calls, you want that seller to go, I choose you, because you're not alone in the one that wants to buy a great business. And that's hopefully what a lot of the folks listening that are owners of the Amazon FBA businesses and e-commerce and SaaS businesses, content businesses in general, it really doesn't matter. You want to build a great asset and build a great reputation for yourself so that guys like RJ and Case and other great professional buyers are willing to pay you maximum value for your business in a seamless, painless, exciting process so everybody prospers at the end. RJ, you're awesome. I look forward to working with you for the next 24 months, no more, because you're going to buy 93 in 24 months and then you're done, right?
Yeah, can sequence off. We'll see.
All right. I'll work with you as long as you choose to work with us here at Quiet Light Brokers.
Well, we're eventually, you know, at some point I'm going to find somebody smarter than me to run this, and then I'll come work with you guys.
There you go. Well, it's a privilege talking with you. Thanks so much for your time.
Awesome.
Appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks, Joe. Take care.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Quiet Light Podcast. For more resources from this episode, head over to quietlightbrokerage.com. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in iTunes. This helps share the messages from the show with more business owners like you.